Trump's policies aren't just hurting the markets. According to the Atlanta Fed, so far, growth in the current quarter was a stunning negative 2.8%, signaling that the GDP is shrinking at the fastest pace since the pandemic lockdown. In the first Trump term, it took a disease to destroy the economy. This time, he is the disease.
Yep. Nothing to have.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. And yes, we stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. A lot going on, but some good news, I think, or maybe hopeful news, perhaps.
I'll take it. I don't blame you.
As I will try to explain here, Desi Doyen, amid a pretty dark story that developed quickly overnight and then into today. Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested by Philippine officials on Tuesday on a warrant from the International Criminal Court accusing him of crimes against humanity over deadly supposed anti-drugs crackdowns that he oversaw while he was in office, according to the Philippine government. Nearly 3 years after Duterte left office, it was a major step taken toward accountability for thousands of Filipinos who have long sought justice for their loved ones. Duterte was taken into custody at the Manila International Airport after arriving back home from Hong Kong with his family, becoming the first former Asian leader to be arrested by the global court. He was later driven to a nearby airbase. Later on Tuesday, the former president was on his way to The Hague in the Netherlands to face ICC accusations that he committed crimes against humanity during that deadly supposed war on drugs. For years, reports the New York Times' Sue Lee Wee and Camille Alimia today, the bodies piled up. Some were shot by vigilantes on motorbikes. Others had bullets in the head, execution style. In killing after killing, the police would only describe the victims as, quote, drug suspects who had resisted arrest, a charge that rarely stood up to even minor scrutiny. And yet the slaughter continued with impunity at the behest of the man who was elected president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. The ICC accused the 79-year-old Duterte, so he's 1 year older than Donald Trump, for those maybe paying attention, accused him of crimes against humanity during his time as president and when he was the mayor of the city of Davao. His case will be a high-profile test, the Times says, of the court, which in recent months has sought the arrest of Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the head of the military junta in Myanmar on the same charges as Duterte. But those orders are unlikely to come to fruition. The paper reports, much like the court's warrant for President Vladimir Putin of Russia that was issued 2 years ago. Duterte's camp said his detention was illegal, arguing in part that the ICC had no jurisdiction in the Philippines because he had withdrawn the country from the court when he was president. But in the warrant, a three-judge panel wrote that it was investigating killings during the time the Philippines was still a member of the court and this is key, the nation remains a member of Interpol, which can seek arrests on behalf of the ICC. For the record again, for those who might be keeping score at home, the U.S. is also not a member of the ICC, but it is a member of Interpol, for whatever that little nugget of information might be worth. Who knows? Could be useful for the years ahead, just saying. The ICC is a court of last resort that prosecutes genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity when countries are unwilling or unable to do so. The ICC suspended its investigation in late 2021, after the Philippines said that it was already investigating the same allegations and that the ICC therefore had no jurisdiction. But appeals judges at the ICC rejected that argument in July of 2023, ruling that the court inquiry could in fact proceed. In November, the Philippines said for the first time that it would be obliged to comply if an arrest warrant for the elder Duterte were issued by Interpol. A representative of Interpol was, in fact, present when the Filipino law enforcement arrested Duterte. Interesting and noted.
Yes.
It was the Philippine law enforcement that did the arrest on behalf of Interpol, of their own president, their own former president. Okay. Duterte's arrest pierced the culture of impunity that he had built around his so-called death squads. Even after his single 6-year term ended, he seemed to be above justice. Again, some of this is just sounding so familiar. His successor, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., rose to the presidency after forming a political alliance with Duterte's daughter, Sarah, who became vice president. And by the way, she still is vice president. Early in his administration, Marcos indicated that he would not cooperate with the ICC, but ties between Mr. Marcos and Ms. Duterte unraveled quickly and in spectacular fashion. So by late 2023, Marcos's government had quietly allowed ICC investigators to enter the Philippines. Before he was elected in 2016, Duterte announced that he would crack down on drugs and that the country's, quote, drug pushers, hold up men and do nothings, unquote, had better leave because he would, quote, kill them. According to official government figures, more than 6,200 people were killed in, quote, anti-drug operations during Duterte's 6-year term from 2016 to 2022. Almost all of them said to have been drug sellers or users who officials say resisted arrest during raids. International human rights groups, however, put that number not at 1,600, but closer to 30,000. Soon after Duterte was inaugurated, a group of policemen barged, for example, into Mary Ann Domingo's tiny apartment, the Times reports, citing just one gruesome example, killing her partner and her son. Even as he took responsibility for the carnage, Duterte seemed untouchable, at least until Tuesday. His arrest brought tears of joy and frustration to many. Quote, "It took so long, so many lives," said Grace Garganta, 32, whose father and brother were both killed by masked men just a few hours apart in July of 2016 in Navotas. Quote, "I almost lost hope, but this has renewed the sense of hope in me because even small victims like us can stand a chance against Duterte and his powerful men," she said in tears. In Manila, a coffee shop staffed primarily by the mothers and wives, sisters and daughters of the drug war victims, offered customers 50% off drinks to celebrate. In Quezon City, a special mass was organized to remember the victims whose photographs were placed before candles. Quote, "I'm ecstatic," said Lila De Lima, a former senator who had been detained for 6 years after she criticized Duterte's war on drugs. She said, "This is something I had been hoping and praying for, and here it is. The time for reckoning is before us." For decades, Duterte operated with seemingly no bounds as mayor of Davao, the second largest city in the Philippines. For more than two decades, he ran a deadly anti-drug crackdown with impunity. In 2016, for the record, the same year that Donald Trump was first elected, he parlayed his law and order credentials into a victory in the presidential election, even though experts said the country did not even have an outsized problem with drugs. You may recall that Donald Trump was a fan of Duterte's, even years after his extrajudicial executions of supposed drug dealers and users was widely known. Trump called to praise the then Philippine president, according to a White House readout of a phone call between the two men from April of 2017. In the call, Trump, according to his own White House, said, quote, "I just want to congratulate you because I am hearing of the unbelievable job on the drug problem." That, according to the transcript put out by the White House before he continued to tell Duterte, quote, "Many countries have the problem. We have a problem. But what a great job you are doing, and I just wanted to call and tell you that." Again, this is a man who international human rights groups have said killed 30,000 people. Even as they continue to mourn, many Filipino relatives of people killed by Duterte, according to the Times, could not imagine a day when Duterte would be in custody. Well, they can imagine it now. In the warrant calling for his arrest, three judges of the ICC said that they believed Mr. Duterte was responsible for the drug war killings that took place when he was president and mayor of Davao, and that there were reasonable grounds to believe that these attacks were, quote, both widespread and systematic. Raquel Fortune has examined 117 bodies, many with multiple shots to the head and the torso, from the drug war. In her role as a forensic pathologist, she said she had always asked each one of those bodies for help in seeking justice. With Tuesday's developments, Fortune and the thousands of people killed extrajudicially under Duterte's murderous regime, a regime praised by our own president at the time and their families, well, they are all one big step closer to seeing that justice, it seems. Now, at the top, I described all of this as maybe good or perhaps hopeful news, as dark as it is. It's obviously good and hopeful news for the families of the victims of Duterte's strongman killing spree, but it also jumped out at me when it came across the wires late on Monday. Because it was interesting to see that even in a non-ICC country like, say, I don't know, the U.S., but one that is still a member of the Interpol, the international police, like, I don't know, the U.S., that domestic law enforcement agents might, if necessary someday, in cases where nations like, I don't know, the U.S. are unable to police themselves for crimes against humanity, that maybe international bodies might be able to step in with the help of domestic law enforcement to arrest at least a former leader who may have reason to believe that he is above the law and that he can never be held accountable for his acts.
It's interesting that the Philippines police had so much courage.
Now, I'm not saying that Donald Trump has committed crimes against humanity. Let me be clear about that, at least not yet. But I suspect that even he noticed what happened in the Philippines overnight to his friend, first elected in the same year that he was, and who he praised for his killing spree against his own people. All, as mentioned, noted. Perhaps there is a way out of the darkest ends that our stupidest current timeline could go in the days ahead. Told you it was a dark story, but, you know, welcome to the broadcast. And hi again, Desi Doyen.
Hi, this is where we are.
In lighter news, and also somewhat related to your Green News report coming up a little bit later, Des.
Yeah.
The U.S. has doubled down on its trade war against our friendly neighbor Canada, once again threatening it with annexation. The stock market continues to plummet, and we may be headed into a recession in response to all of it.
Woohoo! See? Sounds like fun.
The lighter news. President Donald Trump said Tuesday he would double his planned tariffs on steel and aluminum from 25% to 50% against Canada. Tuesday's escalation and the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and Canada only compounded the rising sense of uncertainty in terms of how Trump's tariff hikes will play out. Trump said in a long and rambling, sometimes all caps, sometimes not, post on his failing money-losing social media website, whose stock crashed still further, another 1.5% on Tuesday after plummeting more than 11% in a single day on Monday. He said that the increase of the tariffs from 25 to 50, set to take effect on Wednesday, was in response to the 25% price hike that Ontario's conservative premier, Doug Ford, put on electricity that is sold to several states in the U.S. After a brutal stock market sell-off on Monday, further jitters on Tuesday, as AP reports it, Trump faced increased pressure to show that he has a solid plan to grow the economy. So far, the president is doubling down on the tariffs he talked up repeatedly during the 2024 campaign. The U.S. president has given a variety of explanations for his antagonism of Canada, saying that his separate 25% tariffs are about fentanyl smuggling, even though the tiniest amount of the drugs actually of that drug actually comes into the U.S. via Canada. And voicing objections to Canada putting high taxes on dairy imports that he claims penalize U.S. farmers. In the very same social media post, he also used the threats of a growing trade war against the country that has long been our friend, our northern ally, to once again call for them to become the property of the United States. Quote, "The only thing that makes sense is for Canada to become our cherished 51st state." Well, he certainly sounds like he cherishes them, doesn't he? Adding, this would make all tariffs and everything else totally disappear. But as we noted yesterday, incoming Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, elected to the role over the weekend, said that his government will keep tariffs in place until Americans show respect and commit to free trade after Trump threatened historic financial devastation for his country. As you will recall, all of this comes after Trump, during his first term, praised a slightly updated NAFTA trade agreement with Canada and Mexico that was renamed the USMCA as the greatest and most fairest free trade deal ever devised on planet Earth, only to then claim that it wasn't fair in his second term as he unleashed tariffs against Canada, despite the fact that the new negotiations, that there are scheduled new negotiations for the USMCA already scheduled for next year under the agreement itself. So if he had a problem with it, seems like he could have waited a few months, but that's not our Donald Trump, is it? Carney said Trump's latest tariffs are an attack on Canadian workers, families, and businesses, saying, quote, "My government will keep our tariffs on until the Americans show us respect and make credible, reliable commitments to free and fair trade." Canadian officials are planning retaliatory tariffs in response to Trump's specific steel and aluminum tariffs, reportedly as of Tuesday morning. Those are expected to be announced on Wednesday. Carney was referring in his statement to an initial $30 billion Canadian dollars, or $21 billion U.S., worth of retaliatory tariffs that have been applied on items like American orange juice, peanut butter, coffee, appliances, footwear, cosmetics, motorcycles, and so forth. Ontario's conservative premier, again, Doug Ford, after responding to Trump by raising electricity prices on certain U.S. states, said Tuesday on MSNBC that the people and business leaders in the U.S. need to speak up against the, quote, chaos caused by Trump's launching of a trade war.
I apologize to the American people that President Trump decided to have an unprovoked attack on our country, on families, on jobs, and it's unacceptable. I'm not too sure why he continues to attack his closest friends and allies. Doubling the tariff on aluminum, that the U.S. only can manufacture 16% aluminum that they need, the balance, for the most part, comes from Quebec. Over 60, 65%, it's going to hurt your manufacturing. Again, I stress, this is not the American people. Canadians know it. And if we go into a recession, it's self-made by one person. It's called President Trump's recession, which shouldn't be this way. We should be booming both countries right now.
I love that he's so Canadian that he apologized to the U.S. for the fact that Trump attacked Canada.
Yes.
Trump,
we really don't deserve neighbors that good.
And that's Doug Ford, who ain't that good, by the way. But anyway, Trump condemned the use of electricity as a bargaining chip and a threat, saying in a separate social media post that Canada, quote, will pay a financial price for this so big that it will be read about in history books for many years to come, unquote. Ontario provides electricity to Minnesota, New York, and Michigan, and Trump pledged to declare a national emergency in those states, which he believes would allow him to take extraordinary measures to add more coal-fired power plants, speed up or bypass altogether permitting requirements for new plants, for new transmission lines, etc. But after all of this, late on Tuesday, seemingly cooler heads prevailed, at least for the moment. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said on Tuesday that Tuesday afternoon that the U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick can't believe I'm calling him a calmer head. But Howard Lutnick called him and Ford agreed to remove the retaliatory surcharge that he had vowed on Monday, saying that he was now confident that the U.S. president would also stand down on his own plans for 50% tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum.
Well, just a little while ago, I had an opportunity to speak to Secretary Lutnick. And Secretary Lutnick has sent out an olive branch to us to come down and immediately meet with him, meet with the whole trade administration, and discuss the future. Rather than waiting till April the 2nd, threats going back and forth, tit for tat, I've agreed to suspend temporarily, and we always have that tool in our toolkit, until we sit down over the next day or two. I'll be heading down to Washington along with Dominic LeBlanc, and we'll have a good discussion. They understand how serious we are about the electricity and the tariffs. And rather than going back and forth and having threats to each other, we have both agreed, let cooler heads prevail. We need to sit down and move this forward.
That was Ontario Premier Doug Ford. Now, there is some confusion about whether the White House is how far they are actually backing down. According to the BBC, and I'm not sure if this is the latest or not, but White House officials say the U.S. will impose 25% tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, just not the 50% that Trump had announced earlier. Your guess is as good as mine, and by the time you hear this show, it all could change. Trump was
which
set to...
Which is great for the markets. They love that
Oh, they do.
Of
oh, they love uncertainty. Yeah. Trump was set to deliver a Tuesday afternoon address to the Business Roundtable, which is a trade association of CEOs, that during the 2024 campaign, he wooed with the promise of lower corporate tax rates for domestic manufacturers. But his tariffs on Canada and Mexico and China and steel and aluminum and everything else, with plans for more to possibly come on Europe and Brazil and South Korea and on pharmaceutical drugs and on copper and lumber and computer chips, well, that would amount to a massive tax hike. A hike, not a reduction, but a hike on U.S. manufacturers. Harvard University economist Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary for the Clinton administration, on Monday put the odds of a Trump recession, or Trump session, as it is already being described, at about 50-50 at this point, saying, quote, all the emphasis on tariffs and all the ambiguity and uncertainty has both chilled demand and caused prices to go up. Summers posted on X, we are getting the worst of both worlds, concerns about inflation and an economic downturn and more uncertainty about the future, and that slows everything, said Summers. But Trump set off alarms in an interview that was broadcast on Fox News on Sunday, in which he did not rule out a possible recession, calling what was going on a, quote, period of transition. And then the stock market fell over a cliff on Monday, and it continued to fall, if slightly less so, on Tuesday after 2 weeks in which all of the market gains since the election last year have been entirely wiped out. Or as Trump calls it, a period of transition. Trump, as AP notes, has long relied on the stock market as an economic and political gauge to follow, only to look past it as he remains determined so far to impose tariffs. When he won the election last year, he proclaimed that he wanted his term to be considered to have started on November 6, 2024, on Election Day, not on January 20, 2025, Inauguration Day, because he wanted to be credited for post-election stock market gains. So, yes, Donald Trump cares very much about the stock market. He also repeatedly warned of an economic freefall if he were to lose the election last year, saying, quote, if I don't win, you will have a 1929-style depression. Enjoy it, he obnoxiously said at an August rally in Pennsylvania. And of course, while he'll try to downplay what's happening now in the stock market and the economy and these trade wars, unless things turn around quite quickly, frankly, this could be extraordinarily damaging to him and his presidency. Remember, Karl Rove figured out way back in the 90s or so, always attack an opponent's strength. Now, Trump's strength is supposed to be business. That was never true, but that's the perception that he sold, that he ran and won on, that he's a great businessman, one of the world's greatest of all time. If there's anything that he knows, it's how to make money and how to make everyone he promised over and over again rich if they elected him as president. Well, now he seems to be attacking himself in that regard. Trade wars, rising prices, falling stock market, tens if not thousands of laid off government workers who will be on the unemployment rolls, setting the GDP back. That all strikes at what he himself declared to be his own strengths. And the fun part here is that he's attacking himself with all of this. And it is working, at least working to take down the one thing that too many Americans believe to be true about him, that he was a genius businessman who would lower prices and improve the economy.
On day one, look how that turned out.
So far, in any case, yeah, he does seem to be doing quite the opposite, doesn't he? We'll see. So far.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how long it'll take the MAGA folks to figure out, oh, hey, he's flip-flopping.
Well, you know, this might be a self-inflicted blow, that sort of the way George W. Bush was invincible as the man who would, you know, keep us all safe until Hurricane Katrina blew in, and then suddenly he was not that at all. This may be that sort of self-inflicted blow that finally maybe does drop the scales from a lot of MAGA eyes to help them see what a failure this guy really is. But we will see. Again, all of it seems like worth noting. And all just over 6 weeks into office. It's all going very well, isn't it? Let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with more food for thought and our Green News Report and a farewell to a friend on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, as usual, there is a lot happening today, and as is the case every day now, and there is a lot that we are, therefore, not covering, that we just simply don't have the time to cover, or that I could cover by just giving you the headlines, but if you listen to the show, you know that we like to sort of get into the details or the context and the background and what it all means going forward, et cetera.
Yeah, and you can get the headlines anywhere, really.
I mean, I could do that for, you know, a half a dozen stories today from the heroic top Justice Department official who resigned on Monday rather than grant disgraced right-wing Hollywood star Mel Gibson his gun rights as ordered by Trump officials, which he lost after being found guilty of domestic violence, to the judge who ordered that one of the organizers of protests at Columbia University last year against Israel's war on Palestine, a permanent U.S. resident with a green card who has who has been charged with no crimes, that he could not be deported just because the Trump administration doesn't like his politics, to the effects of Israel once again cutting off electricity and food and medical supplies to the suffering people of Gaza, to the news late on Tuesday that Ukraine is open to the idea of a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine, in Russia's three-year war against them as peace talks attempt to get underway in Saudi Arabia, to Donald Trump at the White House on Tuesday after his co-president Elon Musk's company Tesla has lost about 50% of its value since Musk began co-presidenting after his hard right turn, when Trump reportedly at the White House literally read a Tesla sales pitch complete with pricing at the White House.
Although it does mean that, hey, maybe the Tesla protests are having an effect.
All of that after he announced last night on social media that he was going to be buying a brand new Tesla to say thanks to his friend Elon. I could go on and on, and I could cover each of those stories and actually dozens more today in detail. But I want to take a few minutes to share some thoughts that I think are worth pondering that I've been thinking about in over the last few hours after hearing the news of a loss of a friend that you may know. Now, these ideas don't necessarily offer solutions to what this nation is going through right now, but they may be a start. And in any event, they offer some food for thought that I think are worth sort of adding to the discourse right now. This is from a recent thread on Blue Sky, where you will find me at the Brad Blog, from Elliot Higgins. He's a journalist, founder, and director of Bellingcat, a Netherlands-based investigative journalism group founded back in 2014 that specializes in fact-checking and open-source intelligence, meaning reporting on stuff that is available and open to be read and pointed to and sourced. Bellingcat publishes investigations that are conducted by both professional and citizen journalists who, as you may have heard me note over the years, are often the ones who have been sort of a critical antidote to a corporate media, which has, over the past couple of decades, failed us time and time again at critical times leading to what Higgins describes in his thread as disordered discourse, where citizens and citizen journalists have stepped up on blogs and social media to tell the truth and to try to help push the corporate media and the politicians and sometimes the state itself back towards ordered discourse. Anyway, Higgins wrote in a thread on Blue Sky recently from the Netherlands, "What we're witnessing in America is what happens when disordered discourse captures a political party and then the state itself. The Republican Party," he notes, "was the first to fall, abandoning truth for conspiracy, ideology for grievance, and policy for performative outrage. Now, with its grip on institutions, disordered discourse isn't just shaping politics. It has overtaken those in power who now govern as if manufactured narratives were reality, eroding the state and democracy itself from within. Disordered discourse doesn't just govern through those who believe its manufactured narratives. It forces even those who don't to submit. To stay in power, they must either bend the knee to the lies or become the next target of the machine that they helped to create. America is not unique," notes Higgins. "Any democracy can fall to state capture by disordered discourse if there is no systematic response. This isn't something we can fact check our way out of," he says. "It's deeper than misinformation. It's about power, identity, and the narratives that shape reality itself. We're living through a fundamental shift in how discourse is created. Institutions once shaped a shared reality through discourse, imperfectly, but with structure. Now that reality has splintered. That reality has splintered. In its place, engagement-driven ecosystems amplify whatever resonates. Truth is optional. The result? A fragmented public consciousness where competing realities coexist, each self-enforcing and resistant to correction. When truth is no longer a shared foundation, power shifts to those who control the most compelling narrative, no matter how detached from reality it may be. Democracies," he notes, "weren't built around this. They depend on a shared reality, however contested, in order to function. When governance becomes a battle between competing fictions rather than policy and truth, institutions designed for debate and compromise become tools for enforcing narratives. The end result is what we are seeing in the U.S., writes Higgins from the Netherlands. "A democracy struggling to function because its institutions are trapped in disordered discourse. Governance becomes not about solving problems, but demonstrating loyalty to manufactured narratives." I suspect all of this is sounding quite familiar. He writes, "If you think this can't happen outside the U.S., consider that we're all subject to the same forces. Social media-driven discourse, collapsing institutional trust, and the rise of narratives untethered from reality. It's a systemic vulnerability in every democracy," Higgins argues. "We need to consider what this means for our democracies at the most fundamental level. If governance is shaped by engagement-driven narratives over reality, how do institutions survive?" Great questions. If truth is irrelevant to power, what stops disordered discourse from capturing the state everywhere? Disordered discourse thrives on systemic drivers, engagement-driven algorithms, collapsing trust in institutions, news influencer, shaping reality through identity, and the erosion of shared discourse. These forces don't just distort politics, he writes, they reshape democracy itself. He goes on in a second thread, noting there is no single fix, but one crucial pillar of the response to overcoming or combating disordered discourse is education. He says it starts at the primary level. It's critical that critical thinking is not abstract. It's the ability to assess information, recognize manipulation, and engage thoughtfully.
And he does point out different countries where they are starting this kind of media literacy education, literally in elementary school.
In Finland, media education has become part of schools since 1950s. It's woven into the curriculum in Finland. Students learn about propaganda, misleading statistics, even create their own media message to understand how narratives shape perception. Estonia has a mandatory high school course called Media and Manipulation, where students analyze persuasion techniques, fact checks, and recognize propaganda. The goal is not to turn everyone into an investigator. It's not about making people into mini belling cats, he says. It's about equipping them with the basic skills to navigate a fragmented information landscape. By the way, skills that it seems to me we have, I don't know if we ever had in this country, but we've certainly lost them in many cases. There's more. I'll link to Higgins' thread when I post today's show at bradblog.com. But he concludes this way, education alone is not enough. If we teach people how to think critically but leave them without real ways to engage, we don't strengthen democracy, we deepen the disconnect. These skills need to lead somewhere toward participation, towards power, towards making truth matter. The alternative? We let disordered discourse continue its takeover of institutions, eroding democracy from within. If truth is no longer relevant to power, then power will belong to those who control the most compelling narrative, whether it is real or not. Now, reviewing Higgins' thread today, well, I was looking at it as I was thinking about the work of Kevin Drumm, one of the earliest sort of, I think, data-driven citizen journalists, bloggers from the old guard blogging world. Well, the OG blogging world lost a friend, a mentor, and an inspiration this week. The Brad blog and Bradcast lost all of those things as well. Along with a favorite on-air guest many times over the past 20 years or so. Kevin Drumm initially rose to prominence through the popularity of his independent blog, Cal Pundit, which ran from 2003 to 2004. Before he was then invited to launch the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog from 2004 to 2008, which I think is where I first got to know him and his work and get to know him personally. He then moved on to Mother Jones in 2008, where he blogged and wrote for the print magazine there for 12 years. And finally, in 2021, as he describes it, at what will have been his last blog called Jabberwocking, he, quote, came full circle, leaving Mojo, Mother Jones, to once again blog at his own independent site. As noted, Kevin was a friend and a mentor, and I believe the first time that I met him in person, he had brought a bunch of bloggers together, a bunch of
yes.
L.A. bloggers,
yes.
Los Angeles bloggers, brought them together for lunch at something we call the Farmers Market out here in L.A. And I remember it was then I had just started blogging myself a couple of years right after he did. But I was stunned to learn in talking to him, as he told some of us at the time, that he never actually reads comments on his on his blog articles.
Always a wise choice.
I didn't understand that at the time. I thought, well, that's crazy. Now I'm kind of understanding. Well, OK, I get it. I do get it. For the record, I do read the comments on my blog articles, even now, even today, even 20 years later. But I thought that was an interesting tidbit. I recall that he came over to my house at one point to sit on the back patio for hours in the cold. And it was hours we were back there talking about elections and specifically election integrity, concerns about voting systems, because he really wanted to understand my concerns about them so that he could share them with his own readers at Mojo back at the time, as I recall. I have no idea what year that was, but I remember the conversation. His work was data-driven, was fact-based. And he was really, really good at creating charts and graphs that helped underscore his stories with facts and sourcing and stuff. The things that I think Bellingcat would appreciate. And by the way, they didn't come around until, I don't know, more than a decade after Kevin had been already groundbreaking in this particular field. He was a key proponent also of Friday cat blogging, which some may remember from the old days.
Oh, yeah. He also had a really impactful analysis in Mother Jones. One of his most important hypotheses was an analysis he did on lead-based poisoning as an explanation for the high crime rates in the 70s, particularly lead paint chips. And he noted that when lead paint was phased out, that crime rates went down. So he posited that that was less of a factor.
Again, correlating data. Different data sets to, you know, make sense of things for us in this world, to order our discourse, if you will. And you may have heard him on the show. He was last year, back in 2023, to talk about the Republican Party's threat at the time to crash the U.S. economy again by defaulting the U.S. government, because Republicans refused to raise the debt limit at the time again. And Kevin, as I recall, was daring them to, well, go ahead and try it. He was advising the Biden administration that if Republicans refuse to raise the debt limit, to simply keep paying the bills anyway and let Republicans try to take him to court for it. Try to sue him for paying the bills of the things that America already owed. And by the way, to point out that the Constitution says the debt of the United States shall not be questioned. He thought that the Biden administration would have a pretty good case if that happened. It never came to that. As usual, the GOP backed down. But that was the last time we had Kevin on the show, even though I had been thinking about him just a few days ago, wanting to have him back on. Sadly, that will not be happening. In 2014, as he explained on his blog, he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a cancer of the bone marrow. It's currently incurable, Kevin wrote at the time, but modern treatments are pretty good, and I remain alive and hopeful that a cure is on the way. In his final blog item, he noted that his health was getting worse, quipping, "These guys are going to kill me before they figure out what's wrong." On Monday night, his wife, Maria, wrote one last health update on Kevin's jabberwocking blog, writing, "With a heavy heart, I have to tell you that after a long battle with cancer, my husband, Kevin Drum, passed away on Friday, March 7, 2025. No public memorial services are planned," she wrote. "In lieu of flowers, please donate to the charity or political cause of your choice." A Facebook in memory of Kevin Drum has been created, she said, as a place for friends and family to share memories of Kevin. I encourage you to post your thoughts and memories there. Thank you to all the wonderful blog readers who supported, encouraged, and challenged him over through the years. He will be greatly missed.
Yes.
He will indeed. Kevin Drum, blogger, journalist, citizen journalist, hell of a good guy, was 66 years old. The Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it. If you enjoy the show and or get something from it, please give back a bit if you can by visiting us at bradblog.com/donate. Your support helps Desi and me continue to bring you real, independent, progressive news 5 days a week over your public airwaves. We simply can't do it without your help, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to make a one-time donation, or even better, automated monthly support. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you can rest easy knowing that we'll be here every day making sense of it all, or at least trying to. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thanks. What a day, eh?
Yeah, no kidding.
All right, well, no doubt you will cheer us all up, as ever, with your latest Green News Report.
Climate change is an existential threat.
Climate action champion becomes Canada's new prime minister. Oil tanker explosion spills jet fuel into England's North Sea. Trump administration orders vast increase in logging of the public's national forests, plus...
Enjoy watching them now, because they are disappearing.
One in five butterflies in the U.S. have disappeared in the last 20 years.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and... snarky comment.
Donald Trump has been busy. In the past couple of days, he's switched sides in the war in Ukraine, announced a national crypto reserve, and dismantled the National Weather Service, because part of the fun of experiencing a Category 5 hurricane is the surprise.
Surprise! This is your Green News Report.
All right, Desi Doyen, a lot to get to today around the world, beginning with a disturbing story off the coast of England.
Yes, on Monday, just off the coast of England, a cargo ship collided with a U.S.-flagged oil tanker carrying jet fuel for the U.S. military, sparking a massive fire. Officials confirmed that the damaged tanker is spilling the fuel into the North Sea.
In another remarkable metaphor at sea.
Yep. In New York's Long Island, officials say fire crews have finally contained several fast-spreading, wind-driven wildfires that broke out over the weekend amid unusually dry conditions. A similar situation in Japan. That country's worst wildfire in 50 years is now under control, also exacerbated by drought and unseasonably warm temperatures.
Clearly, Long Island and Japan are not sweeping their forest floors.
In Australia, Queensland was hit by its first tropical cyclone in more than 50 years, fueled by extremely warm ocean waters. In Alaska, the world's most famous sled dog race, the Iditarod, is now underway, but organizers were forced to move the starting line from Anchorage to Fairbanks, Alaska, due to lack of snow. In Alaska. In Canada, Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, on Monday followed through on his threat to slap a 25% surcharge on all electricity exports to the U.S. Mm. in retaliation for the Trump administration's tariffs on Canadian products. Mm-hmm. Mark Carney, a former banker and climate action champion, won his Liberal Party's election in a landslide on Sunday and will replace Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister of Canada until parliamentary elections are held. Carney previously served as United Nations Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance, consistently warning for years about the dire financial impacts that climate change is already having on the insurance and financial sector.
Wait, he's a banker and he believes in climate change?
Yes.
Wow.
Here he is on UN TV.
To see that the number of extreme weather events had tripled and the cost of those events had gone up five times in the course of a quarter of a century absolutely rammed home the point of the scale of the issue, and then also how little effectively was being done about it in the financial sector.
Speaking of how little is being done about it in the financial sector, climate science denier Donald Trump is demolishing U.S. climate policies. The Trump Securities and Exchange Commission has begun rolling back Biden-era climate disclosure rules that required companies to inform investors about the risks that climate impacts pose to their businesses.
What you don't know can kill you.
The Trump EPA has moved to rewrite Biden-era chemical safety standards designed to prevent disasters at manufacturing plants across the country. The New York Times reports that the Trump Justice Department will withdraw a landmark lawsuit addressing pollution from a Louisiana petrochemical plant that poses a danger to nearby communities.
Not anymore. No lawsuit. Everything's fine.
Trump recently signed an executive order to massively increase logging in the public's national forests and directed federal agencies to find ways to bypass endangered species protections and other environmental rules to protect air and and water quality.
Who needs them?
Forest ecologists warn that increased logging will worsen wildfire risks, water pollution, and accelerate species extinctions. Trump also selected a lumber industry executive to head the Forest Service.
Perfect.
Finally, speaking of accelerating extinction, butterflies in the United States are disappearing at a catastrophic rate that could upend ecosystems and undercut pollination that sustains America's crops. The total number of butterflies in the contiguous United States has declined 22% over just the last 20 years. Some species have hit losses of more than 90% due to habitat loss, toxic pesticides and herbicides, and rising temperatures driven by man-made global warming. That's according to a comprehensive new study in the journal Science. The researchers say conservation can save America's butterflies.
We are killing it, literally. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
See the dog and butterfly up in the air.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen,
yes.
And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download them always for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who hit a donate button while you're there, or if you want, just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. To help us stay on your public airwaves and cover stuff that, well, you may or may not hear elsewhere. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on all of the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog, but especially Blue Sky. If you're not over there, go ahead and sign it up. It's like Twitter without all the right-wingers.
Yeah.
Twitter minus the Nazis.
Twitter in the old days when it was actually a nice way to have conversations with people you'd never met.
I am the Brad Blog there. Desi Doyen can be found also at Blue Sky and everywhere else at
Green News Report.
There you go. I think that's it. We'll see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Dog and butterfly.